So, as I said, this is the last of the seven deadly sins, gluttony, and it is an interesting one. It's more, as I studied it these past couple weeks, I've seen it's a little bit broader than what we tend to think of gluttony. I'll talk about the narrow definition, then I'll talk about the broad definition a little bit, because the narrow definition is important, especially in America. I looked at the most recent statistic is 50% of Americans are overweight. So that's one out of every two Americans are overweight. That's pretty intense. So the narrow definition is gluttony is an inordinate love or excessive indulgence of eating and drinking. It's a corruption of moral reasoning because gluttony disregards balance and moderation. So that's the key thing there. Where really gluttony, the opposite of gluttony, if you're going to think about the fruit of the Spirit, what's the true opposite of gluttony? It's self-control. Right? Being able to control yourself and to moderate yourself. That's what it is. So enjoying food is not gluttony. Right? We talked about this before. Enjoying food is not gluttony. God gave us food to enjoy. In 1 Timothy 4, verse 4, one of my favorite passages is really cool. Paul is talking to people who thought that eating in general was bad, and so they lived off of like really, you know, crumbs and bread and stuff like that and water. And Paul says, don't you know that the creation is good and it's made to be enjoyed, for it is sanctified or set apart by the word of God and by prayer, which is why most Christians pray before we eat, because we're remembering like, man, this food isn't everything. It is God that is everything. And I'm remembering that this is a gift from him and I want to enjoy this to his glory. Right? Gluttony doesn't do that. Gluttony sees food as an end to itself. Right? So I'm going after food for the sake of food. I'm not doing it to live. I'm not doing it for survival. I'm not even doing it to enjoy. I'm doing it because food in a way has become a god to me. My stomach has become a god to me. Thomas Aquinas, who was, in my opinion, one of the best Christian minds that's ever lived, very smart man, very intelligent. I've gotten a lot out of his philosophical discourses. He actually was one of the theologians back in the medieval ages that came up with seven deadly sins. And he talked about gluttony. He says gluttony, you could be a glutton in five ways. So a lot of people thinking like, well, I'm not a glutton. I don't you know, go to all-you-can-eat buffets and just stuff myself till I die. Well, he said that you could be a glutton in five ways. Listen to this. You could either be a glutton too soon, too expensively, too much, too eagerly, or too daintily. All right, and this is what those mean. Too soon means immediacy. So it means you can't wait. It's the teenager syndrome, right? Where they're like, I'm starving to death, you know? And you're like, and your parents making them food, they're like, I can't wait. You know, you go to the microwave, you got to wait 60 seconds for the mac and cheese to heat up. You're like, that's not going to happen, right? You're trying to make the ramen, you're like, I'm not going to put this in a pot. I'm just going to eat it raw, you know? And you just dump it down your mouth, right? That's gluttony, right? You can't wait to eat. You can't regulate or have any amount of patience for your food. So you eat things too quickly. The next one is too expensively. So this doesn't mean that if you buy fine foods, you're necessarily a glutton. What he means is that like if you looked at your spending habits, how much of your money every month goes towards food, right? And if it is the largest expenditure, you could look at it, maybe I'm kind of a glutton, you know? Like I didn't need to go to this restaurant. I didn't need to do that. Like, you know, if you're looking at it and you're saying, this is the thing in my life that I have set aside the most amount of money for, that could be an issue, right? Again, you're not eating to live. You're living to eat, right? That's become a very important part of your life, and that's how you can do it. Too much is the one that we're most familiar with, right? So someone who actually does sit down and just eats too much. Next one is too eagerly. I don't know exactly what he's talking about with that one. When I read it, I was like, I think what he's talking about, if I had to guess, is I think he's talking about someone who, again, is just very, very, food is just very, very important to them. They're just very, very excited by it. Like they, if you want to put it that way, it just excites them in a really deep way, I guess, a really personal way where, you know, I guess, you know, waking up in the morning, the first thing on their brain is breakfast, you know, and before they go to bed, they're like, I need to eat again. You know, it excites them. It's like the most important part of their day. Too daintily is the fifth one. This one's kind of cool. So too daintily is this, and we've all done it, so be honest, is where you go home and you open the fridge and you look at all the food and you see that there is food there and you close the fridge and you say, there's no food here. Right now, is there really no food when you say that? No, of course there's food. There's just no food that you want to eat, right? That's too daintily. That means you're too picky. That's what it means. So even though there is food that you could eat, you just won't, you won't eat that. You know, it's below you to eat that. You know, your parents or someone takes you out to eat and they buy you a burger and you're like, I only eat turkey burger. You know, that's all that goes into this temple to the Lord. You know, and you're just too dainty about it. You know, you're very picky about what you eat and how you eat. Now, me personally, I'm dainty because I have allergies. But some people are dainty just for the sake of being dainty, right? They won't eat things just because they're like, well, you know, I can't eat that. That's just not delicate enough for me. I need something richer, better, greater. And that's the idea of being a glutton when it comes to being too dainty. Now, the broad definition, so that's the narrow definition, the broad definition of gluttony is actually really intriguing. So this is how the ancient theologians, the medieval theologians thought of gluttony. If you remember when we were talking about envy, when we're talking about sexual lust, when we're talking about greed, the specific definitions of those sins take place in the heart. Meaning someone who's greedy is not necessarily someone who's doing something physically. Meaning someone who's greedy is not necessarily someone who has a ton of cash. Just like someone who lusts sexually is not necessarily someone who's having a lot of sex. It means that they crave it. It means it's on their brain. It's in their heart. They want it all the time. That's what that means. Gluttony is a different type of sin because you can't be a glutton unless you're actually what? Eating. Unless you're actually consuming. And this is how they viewed gluttony in a broad sense. Gluttony is the act of actually indulging in sin, not merely craving it. Right? So again, you can sin in the heart, right? Like Jesus said. If you look at a woman and you lust after her, you've already committed adultery in your heart. That's enviousness. That's covetousness. That's lust. But then if you actually go out and have sex with her, or if you actually do pull up on your phone and begin to view pornography, or if you go and you actually do rip someone off and you get money from them in an illegal way, then you're actually consuming. Now you're a glutton. Now you're going into the sin of gluttony. And because of that, pretty much all sin falls under the umbrella of gluttony, depending on how much you consume, how much you indulge in it. And again, it has a lot to do with moderation and self-control of whether or not you're a glutton. And another thing to understand about this, because of that, that means that all addictions fall under this category. Okay, so if you're talking about an alcoholic, if you're talking about a drug addict, someone like that, they are gluttons. That's their sin. That's their sin issue. That's how you would define it in terms of their relationship with God. Now, this is an interesting quote. I read an article by this guy named Angelo Stagnaro. I think that's how you pronounce it. He's definitely Italian. He wrote an article called Here's a Skinny on Gluttony. Obviously, he's a Catholic. And he said this, gluttony is the perfect metaphor for sin. We have at the core of our respected beings a vast dark chasm whose emptiness cries out to be filled and fulfilled. Unfortunately, there is nothing in this world that can satisfy us, so we want more and more. So he's saying that gluttony is a great metaphor for sin in general. And I'm going to be defending his point because I agree with him. I think that gluttony is a great metaphor for sin in general because of the way it works and how it affects us negatively. So the story that we're going to look at in the Bible, we're going to evaluate the life of one man, and his name is Esau in the Bible. Esau was a glutton. That was his sin issue. And that's what ultimately caused him to be rejected by God. God says multiple times in the Old Testament, Jacob, who is the brother of Esau, he says, Jacob, I have loved, yet Esau I have hated or rejected. Right? Gluttony was the sin that Esau indulged in that made God reject him. So let's talk about what kind of person Esau was and why it did separate him so severely from God. Okay, so I'm going to read you a story that really sums up Esau as a whole. It's Genesis 25, verse 29 through 34. It says, Now Jacob cooked a stew, and Esau came in from the field, and he was weary. And Esau said to Jacob, Please feed me some of that red stew, for I am weary. Therefore, his nickname was called Edom. Edom means red. So that means after this event happened, everybody referred to him as red afterwards in regards to this story. So it became almost like an insult. Okay? But Jacob said, Sell me your birthright as of this day. And Esau said, Look, I'm about to die. So what is this birthright to me? Then Jacob said, swear to me this day. So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. And Jacob gave Esau bread and stew of lentils. Then he ate and drank, arose, and went on his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. Now, isn't that such like a teenager? Jacob's like, dude, give me your birthright. He's like, what good is my birthright? I'm about to die. You know, is that true? Was he really on death's door that he couldn't wait another couple seconds? No. His issue was that he was a glutton. He was a glutton. And as Thomas Aquinas said, he is definitely falls under the category of too soon, the impulsive eater. Now let's talk about why gluttony turned Esau into this kind of man and how it does the same thing in our own hearts and in our own lives. And this is the main thing I'm going to be defending. Gluttony shrinks your self-control through your appetite, and it takes away slowly your ability to love God and others and to experience any genuine joy or trust. Right? So I'll say that again. Gluttony shrinks your self-control through your appetite and ultimately erodes or takes away your ability to love God and others or to experience any meaningful joy or trust in another person. And this is how it does it. So looking at Esau's life, this is how it did in his life, and this is how it does it in our life, no matter what your sin is. So if you look at this story and you're like, yep, I'm like Esau in the fact that food does this to me, then you're in this story. Or if you look at this and you could say any other sin. So I look at this story and I'm like, yeah, this sounds like me when it comes to sexuality. Right? I'm a glutton in regards to sexuality. Or money. Or vanity. Your looks. Your appearance. Or whatever. You know, whatever is your particular issue that you indulge in. You read the story and you see these six observations that I've made of how these things take away your ability to have self-control and to love and to experience joy. Number one, as you feed it, your appetite grows, making it easier and easier to give in the next time. So when you're dealing with food, when you're dealing with eating, if you eat in a particular way, over time your body becomes accustomed to that way of eating. So when we talk about the different Thomas Aquinas' different views of gluttony, in all of them it works that way. If I eat too daintily, meaning if I restrict myself to a very expensive or dainty type of diet, over an amount of time, I won't be able to eat any other type of food because it will make me sick. My appetites have shifted as a result of my consumption. Do you guys understand that? If I eat too much food, over time, your stomach grows. It inflates. It's like a plastic bag, right? It's elastic. So it means the more that you eat, if you consume too much too often, the amount of food that once would have filled you won't fill you anymore. And so because of that, as your appetite grows, your hunger grows with it. Your cravings grow with it. And your ability to resist shrinks. Every sin works that way. Every sin works that way. And we're fools to think otherwise. When I talked about sexual lust in the main service, I said it's kind of funny to me that there's a such thing as a bachelor and bachelorette party where people have a stripper come or they go to a strip club or something like that, and they have a night of wild partying. And in their minds, they're like, I'm going to get this all out of my system by indulging my flesh so that I don't want to cheat anymore once I get married. That's a really, really foolish way of looking at things. That would be the equivalent of me saying, hey man, if you want to get over your gluttony, let me just make you such a big meal that it's going to fill you and satisfy you forever. Right? If I do that and you eat it, guess what? Your stomach grows as a result of that meal. And it's going to make it easier for you to overeat the next time. It's going to make it harder for you to resist because at that time, as your stomach grows, once you eat a certain amount, and you'll be like, okay, well, I'm not full yet. So now you have to eat that amount or else you go hungry. You have to overindulge or else you go hungry. And again, it works that way in all areas of life with sexual lust. So many times I get pulled into my sexual lust thinking like, I'm just going to indulge this time. I'm just going to give in this one time and then it'll get out of my system and I can resist from now on. Not knowing, not understanding that if I give in this time, my appetite's going to grow. And it's going to be that much harder to resist next time. And it's going to be that much more difficult to treat my wife correctly the next time. Think about how that's going to reflect in your relationships. So with God, as your self-control shrinks, as your appetite grows, your room for God is going to become less and less. Because your consumption and your indulgence in sin, or whatever you're doing, is going to take up so much of your time that God, your time with God is going to shrink as a result. Beyond that, you and I both know that the more you give into sin, the more distant you're going to feel from God anyway. So it becomes even the small amount of time that you're going to be able to spend with God is going to be spent feeling guilty and shame-ridden. It means you're never going to actually enjoy God. Because here's the thing about joy. True joy and trust come through tough times, not through good times. Here's what I mean. If you are dealing with a couple and they don't know how to suffer or fight with one another in a good way, they have no roots. And because they have no roots, the smallest thing will topple them over. We call that a shallow relationship, right? Everyone understands this principle, right? It's a shallow relationship. If it's just based on how you feel, if it's just based on what's good for you in the moment, if it's just based on your appetites, you will never develop true roots in any of the joys of your life, right? Imagine if you wanted to do anything. What if you were interested in music? Right? How could you get good at music if you don't learn how to be patient? How could you get good at sports if you don't learn how to be patient, how to suffer, how to learn, how to fail and learn from your failure? How can you get better in your relationship with God if you don't know how to do the tough things? If it's all about your appetite, if it's all about me and impulsive, if you're just like Esau, just like, dude, I don't care, I'm going to die if I don't get the soup in the next 5 seconds. If that's where you're at, you're never going to be able to develop any true meaningful relationship or communion with another person or with God. And that means that true joy and trust will be out of your reach. This is an interesting proverb. It's Proverbs 25, verse 28. Proverbs 25, verse 28 says, "A person without self-control is like a city with broken down walls." In the main service, we're going over the book of Nehemiah right now. And in the book of Nehemiah, it's about the Israelites building the walls around Israel. And it was an important book for me to go through when I first started fighting my sin of pornography, because I realized that my soul really was like a city without walls. A city without walls back then was a sitting duck. Right? As long as no one was attacking that city, they were fine. But the second any intruder came in, they could burn it to the ground like that. And I realized that's how I was. As long as there was no temptation in my life, I was doing great. But the second any amount of temptation came in my life, I fell so fast and so hard. I had no resistance. I had no self-control. You guys understand that? The more you feed your appetites, the less self-control that you'll have. And it gets to the place where your indulgence becomes crazy inappropriate. Numbers 11, verse 32. In Numbers 11, the people of God complain to God about food. They're like, we need food. We miss the food of Egypt. And God says, okay, I'm going to send you doves. So he sends them doves, and we're going to read God's response to them a little bit later. But let's see the people's response. So when God sends the doves, what do? Numbers 11, verse 32. The people stayed up all day, all night, and all the next day gathering quail. Okay? They didn't know when to say enough. It's amazing to me. When I look back at the time where I viewed pornography, there was never a moment where I said, enough. There was never a video I saw, there was never an image I saw that was like, that has satisfied my soul. It just caused me to want to indulge more and more. And the more self-control you lose, the more time you're going to spend in your sin. You can't say no. You can't stop. And it's a scary place to be at when you know you ought to stop. But you know deep down that you can't. You lack the will to do so. These people were up for 48 hours gathering food. I don't know how many of you guys have stayed up for 48 hours straight. I had to do it in the military. Once you pass the 48-hour buffer, you start to hallucinate. Your body craves sleep so much that you actually begin to hallucinate, and it actually is painful in your body to be that long without sleep. These people denied themselves sleep for 2 days to feed their flesh. Now, do you really think they needed 2 days to gather food, enough to eat? It's like they don't have refrigerators. Where are they going to store all that food? It's ridiculous. They just gathered it just to have it. Because you don't know when to quit. You don't know when to say stop. Second, it makes you impulsive and obsessed with the present hour so that you ignore consequences of the future. Right? What's Esau doing? He's gambling his birthright. Now, in that culture, the birthright was one of the most important things you could have as a child. Because in that culture, it's not like in our culture, where if you live with your parents when you're 30, you're kind of a loser, you know, and you need to get out of your parents' house, you need to make your own life, you need to do your own thing. In that culture, you lived with your parents from the day you were born to the day you died, right? You always lived there. Your job was whatever job your parents did. That's what you did. If they were farmers, guess what? You're a farmer. If your dad was a blacksmith, you'd become a blacksmith. You'd work with them all the time. The birthright, especially Esau's birthright as the firstborn, means that Esau would become the next head of that family. He would be the person that everyone would look to. He would have all the money, all the wealth, all the needs of the others would be in his hands. It was one of the most important things you could have in that culture. Esau traded this for a bowl of soup. Right? A very, very foolish trade. The impulsiveness in Esau can be seen in this. And it's because, like I said, his appetite, his indulgence had become so frequent that he didn't know how to resist, he didn't know how to wait, he didn't know how to have patience. So he became very impulsive. What happens when people are very impulsive like this with their appetites? Well, if everybody gave in to what they were feeling in the moment, once again, you would never have a job, you would never grow in skills, you would never have relationships, and you would never be able to develop anything meaningful in your life. Because again, hard times hit everything. And if you're going to jump ship every single time something gets a little bit difficult, if you're going to be impulsive with every desire that you have, and you're just like, man, I feel like doing this, so I'm going to do it. If that's how you are, your life is going to be a train wreck. C.S. Lewis said it this way. He said, you will not be a good Christian, or for that matter, a good atheist, if you don't learn how to tell your emotions when to get off. If you don't know how to experience an emotion and say no to it, you're not going to be able to be good at anything. And that's what gluttony does to you. It shrinks your willpower. It shrinks your ability to say no. And if you can't say no to something as simple as food or even sexuality, do you know how strong emotions are? Man, once we get into emotional sins, this sin's really going to stand out to you guys. How do you say no when you're in the moment and you feel angry at someone, when you feel pissed at somebody and you just want to hit them? How are you going to say no to that strong of a feeling? How are you going to say no to a stronger feeling of sexual desire? Right? When you're feeling it rising up in you, how are you going to say no to that? If you don't know how to resist even the simplest of appetites. Right? When you become an impulsive person, you become a self-destructive person. When you don't think of consequences. See, again, the easiest way to put this is to think about kids. Kids don't understand consequences, right? Every single Halloween, you're going to have the same stupid kid who's going to eat all their Halloween candy in that night, and they're going to get massively sick. And you're like, how could you be so stupid? But then 1 month later, Thanksgiving happens, and all the adults do the same thing. And you're like, that's how you could be that stupid. You just did the same thing. How can you not learn from your mistakes? Why? Because you're impulsive. In your mind, intellectually, you know, by doing this, I'm going to get sick. But in your heart, you don't care. You care only about what this is going to taste like, not what this is going to do to me. That's right. It's a fleeting pleasure, long-term pain, though. Right? Long-term pain. Again, it's amazing to me when I look back at my time viewing pornography where I didn't even think about what the consequences would be. You know, if only I knew, if only I understood the consequences, I would have never engaged in the momentary pleasure. Right? Even just the immediate consequences, right? After I viewed it, feeling that way towards God and seeing the vast emptiness well up inside of me afterwards, I would never do it. It's funny, I used to talk to my friends who got drunk all the time about their gluttony, about their drinking habits. And they'd be like, Martin, you know, you don't understand. They used to call me Martin because of my last name. They're like, Martin, you don't understand, man. Drinking is the best. And I'm like, really? Because I DD for you guys and I see how awesome it is. And like for an hour, it looks like you're having a good time. But then for like 6 hours, you don't remember what you're doing and you're throwing up and you look pretty dang miserable. And then for 2 days afterwards, you look really terrible, right? One of my friends who did a lot of drugs, he used to say this to me. He says, Peter, the higher the high, the more harsh the come down. Right? But when you're engaging in behavior like this, you don't think about the consequences. You don't think about what this is going to feel like when it wears off. You only think about the moment, the momentary pleasure. You become impulsive, and that will destroy your life. Number three, it destroys your conscience. Esau's doing this, and he's not thinking about his dad. He's not thinking about how it's a sinful thing to do. He's not thinking about the consequences, because what's happened is his conscience has been eroded over time. Meaning, the more you give in to something, the easier it becomes to do again. The first time you sin, the first time you engage in behavior, I remember the first time I viewed porn. It was nerve-wracking. It was terrible. I was so nervous. But then the second time, it got a little bit easier. And then the third time, it got a little bit easier. And then the fourth time, it got a little bit easier. Until finally, I got to the place where it became really easy to fall. And my conscience towards God had been so eroded that there was a time where I would fall and I would be like, eh, that sucks. Right? And I would just move on. There was no hardness of heart. There was no sorrow before the Lord. There was no thinking about what I've done. Why? Because I had given in so many times, it became easier and easier, lesser and lesser. Ephesians 4, verse 17 through 20, Paul says this, "This I say, therefore, and testify in the Lord, that you should no longer walk as the rest of the Gentiles walk, in the futility of their mind, having their understanding darkened," right? They can't see what they're doing. "Being alienated from the life of God, because of the ignorance that is in them, because of the blindness of their heart, who being past feeling, have given themselves over to lewdness, to work all uncleanness with greediness." Didn't you notice that phrase? Being past feeling. They can't feel it anymore. Right? Which is, by the way, another reason why you keep going back. As your senses deaden, it takes more and more to get the same result. As your appetite grows. That's how it works. I also want to point out that it says because of the blindness of the heart. In Proverbs 4, when it talks about the wicked man, he says the wicked man stumbles, but he doesn't know what he trips over. Meaning the more you give into something, the more it erodes your ability to see what you're doing to yourself. Why do you think you have to have interventions with people who are alcoholics? Why can't they see how destructive their behavior is? It's because they've given into it so much that it's slowly, over time, blinded them to what it's doing to them. Right? Before someone becomes an alcoholic, they know how bad being an alcoholic would be. They don't want to become. No one wakes up one day and says, "I want to be an alcoholic. I want to be a meth addict. That would be amazing." No one says that. They know that that's bad. But over time of giving into it, their conscience becomes more and more deadened, and the result becomes easier and easier to go towards. Number four, your appetite becomes your God, so you can't truly care for others. The birthright for Esau was his opportunity to truly love and care for his family. But he didn't care about that anymore, because when your appetite grows, all of a sudden it becomes your God. And that means that you won't care about what is happening to the people around you. You become more and more calloused towards the people that you're hurting in your life through your sin. Right? You don't think about the consequences. You don't think about what you're doing to other people because you're so consumed with what's going to please you. Philippians 3, verse 18 through 19 says this, "For many walk, of whom I told you often, and now tell you even weeping, that they are enemies of the cross of God, whose end is destruction," get this, "whose God is their belly, and whose glory is their shame, who set their mind only on earthly things." All right, so you give in so many times, you give in so often, that eventually your appetite becomes your God. It becomes your ultimate Lord and Master that you must serve at all times. And that makes it impossible to love other people. Because you know what love is? Love is putting aside your appetites for the betterment of another. That's what love is. That's what Jesus does for us. Right? So how can you love someone else if your appetites always come first? So I could love my wife as long as her appetites and my appetite are the same thing, but what happens when they're not? Will I have the patience to say no, to deny myself in light of her betterment? Or will I say, "I don't care. This is what I want. And if I don't get it from you, I'm going to get it somewhere else." Right? That's what gluttony does to you. Number five, it won't make pain go away or bring any type of lasting joy. Why do people choose gluttony? Right? Why do people choose gluttony? It's very simple. people who struggle relationally, people who struggle to love other people, they choose gluttony because substances are always there for them where people are not. Substances will always be there for you, but people won't. So sometimes substances become much easier to cope with than relationships. And here's the issue with that. If you cope through substances, what you realize very quickly over time is that this substance can't actually take away the issues of my heart. I went to pornography as a young man because I felt lonely, because I felt depressed, because I felt hopeless. And when you feel like that, sometimes feeling anything is better than nothing. And so pornography gave me passion, and it gave me peace in a life that had none. But here's the thing. After I was done, my problems were still there. Paul, in Ephesians 5, verse 18, says this, "Don't be drunk with wine, which is dissipation, but be filled with the Spirit." See what he's saying? Wine, getting drunk, it's dissipation. It's here 1 second, and it's gone the next. It's like chasing the wind. It dissipates. It goes away. When you get drunk to try to ease your problems are still there when you sober up. Why do you think so many people commit suicide when they get drunk? Why do you think so many people kill themselves when they get high? Because when the inebriation begins to wear off, they realize all my problems are still there, and this didn't fix anything. And in that hopelessness and despair, taking their own life becomes a very, very easy thing to do. I've been trying to use a Disney analogy every single time. I'm going to use The Lion King today. The Lion King is actually surprisingly all about gluttony. You know, like rewatching, I'm like, dude, it's all about gluttony. Right? Because Simba feels so bad because he feels responsible for his dad's death. And he goes into the wilderness and he finds Timon and Pumbaa, and they give him a wonderful philosophy. What is it? Hakuna Matata, man. Ain't no worries. Right? And what do? They just eat all day. And over the course of the movie, you realize that both Timon and Pumbaa have really dark lives, but they're compensating through food. And they come up with like this little club where Simba's like, well, I don't want to think about the past, so I'm just going to eat my problems away. Right? And that becomes their coping mechanism. And it's like really funny that happens. Well, I mean, it's not funny, but it kind of is, where a lot of people who are morbidly obese, when you're like, how did you get that big? Here's why. Their eating has really nothing to do with their hunger. It has everything to do with what's broken inside of them. Right? It has very little to do with their hunger. And for Simba and them, it's the same way. It had very little to do with their hunger. Ironically, the rest of The Lion King actually illustrates the other points I made. The hyenas represent gluttony. And Scar, at one point, lets them... He says, I don't want to keep... Right, Mufasa kept the hyenas under control. But then Scar lets them run free. And what happens? Decimates Pride Rock. Because they don't know when to say enough. They eat, and they eat, and they eat, and they're never satisfied until they've eaten the entire plain dry. And they end up, ironically, starving to death. Right? That's what happens to us. We eat and we eat and we eat, and ironically, we starve to death. Which leads to the final point. Eventually, you'll have so much of it that you'll hate it. But your appetite will be so strong that you still can't leave. In Numbers 11, when God is responding to his people for their complaint, this is what he says to them. In verse 18, he says, "Then you," speaking to Moses, "you shall say to the people, consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow you shall eat meat. For you have wept in the hearing of the Lord, saying, who will give us meat to eat? For it was well with us in Egypt. Therefore the Lord will give you meat, and you will eat of it. You shall eat not 1 day or 2 days or 5 days or 10 days or 20 days, but a whole month until it comes out of your nostrils and becomes loathsome to you." How does God judge sin? By giving you exactly what you asked for until it becomes loathsome to you. Proverbs 25, verse 16 says this, "Have you found honey? Eat only as much as you need, lest you be filled with it and vomit." There's such thing as too much of a good thing. And eventually, after you give in to your sin enough, after you become so much of a glutton, you will hate what you do because you realize it didn't solve any of my problems. It didn't make me any better. You'll see all the negative impacts of what it's doing to you, but you won't be able to stop. I'll give you the ultimate example that I viewed in my own life. There was a man who became so sexually just given into his sexuality so much that he was married, but he cheated on his wife so many times that eventually he contracted the HIV virus, didn't tell his wife about it, gave it to her. So now both of them were under a death sentence because of what he did. And he came to the group a couple times, and then he left and kept doing his thing. And basically his mentality was just like, well, you know, I'm going to die. Might as well go out doing what I love. All right, so even though he saw it was literally killing him, that wasn't enough to stop him because his appetite had grown so much. It's so crazy to talk to someone who's a diabetic, right? Type 2 diabetes, they're in their 70s, their 80s, and you just see them just eating ice cream and stuff like that, and you're like, it's going to kill you. But they don't care. The present moment consumes them, and their appetite is so large that even though they hate it, it's the only pleasure they know. Something's better than nothing, right? And that's what people think. In Hebrews 12, verse 16 through 17, we see the fate of Esau. The writer of Hebrews comments on his life, and he says this, "Be careful lest there be any fornicator or profane person like Esau, who for one morsel of food sold his entire birthright. For you know that afterward, when he wanted to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no place for repentance, though he sought it diligently with tears." Why did God reject him? God didn't reject him because he made one mistake. God rejected him because of a lifetime of gluttony, of rejecting the hard path in light of the easier one. What does Jesus say? "Straight is the way, and narrow is the gate that leads to salvation. But broad is the path, and wide is the gate that leads to destruction, and many will find it." The path to Jesus is a path of denying of self. And you can't be a glutton and make it there. You can't be a glutton and say, "I'm going to take up my cross daily for Christ. Man, I'm going to sacrifice for the Lord because he sacrificed everything to me. I'm going to have my life be a living sacrifice unto God, everything to him." You can't do that if you're a glutton. You could try, but you're going to fail. You're going to seek it diligently, even with tears. Man, I've cried over my sin before, but there was no seriousness to my tears. Why? Because at heart, I was still a glutton. Which leads me to the final point that I want to make to you guys, and that's how to escape. Now, in Christianity, we have a lot of bad ways of escaping. Pride and vanity are two big ones. So I look at someone who's overweight and I say, "Don't you want to live to be past 60? You know, don't you want to be able to take care of your kids? Don't you want to have energy? Don't you know that being fat is ugly? Don't you know this? Don't you know that?" Right? And what am I appealing to when I say things like that? Pride and envy. Pride and envy. I talk to someone who's viewing porn, like, "Don't you know it's going to ruin your marriage? Don't you know that this is what it's doing to your brain? And don't you know it's doing this? And don't you know it's doing that?" I'm appealing to your pride. I'm appealing to your selfishness, what you want out of life. So now you're just going to be a glutton in a different way. I have not healed you. I've made your problem worse. Beyond that, there's something in addiction circles, we call it being a dry drunk. Being a dry drunk is someone who is sober, but is still the same person underneath. So yeah, they're not drinking anymore, but they're still the same impulsive jerk that they were before. Meaning this, you can't change the heart through wills of action. It's the other way around. The heart changes the actions. When the actions try to change the heart, you'll get nowhere. Jesus said this to the Pharisees. He says, "You Pharisees, you clean the outside, but you don't focus on the inside. Clean the inside and everything will be clean." Right? You're focusing on the outside. You're trying to do outside in Christianity. He says, it doesn't work that way. Something needs to happen to your heart, and that impacts the rest of your life. That's how it works, right? Which means that I'm going to give you guys three ways that we can get free of gluttony. Now, these are things that need to be applied from today till the day you die, right? These are not things that you can apply once and then you can just forget about them. These are things you need to apply from today till the day you die. Number one, know why you're escaping. Have a reason, have a passion, have a motivation greater than yourself to stop. 1 Corinthians 9, verse 25 through 27 says this, "Do you not know that in a race all runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes through strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last." He's referring to the Olympic Games. He's saying Olympic athletes are super disciplined. And they're disciplined to get what? In their day, it was a wreath. That's it. That's all they got. In our day, what is it? It's a gold medal. You know, and then you're going to be forgotten, like, next month. You know, no one cares about you after that. He says, dude, but they go through all this incredible training just to get something so frivolous. And he says, but what? "Therefore, I don't," but he says, "but we do it to get a crown that will last forever. Therefore, I don't run like someone who is aimless. I don't fight like a boxer that beats the air in futility. I strike a blow to my body and make it my slave so that after I preach to others, I myself will not be disqualified for my prize. I read this to a group of men that I do purity groups with. And I said, why is it that Olympic athletes could be so temperate, they could be so self-controlled for something as stupid and trivial as a gold medal, and yet Christians can't? And they looked at me and they said something very insightful. They said, because we don't understand our prize. That's the truth. That's the truth. When earthly things are so tangible and God is so intangible, it's hard to make Him your goal, isn't it? But here's the thing. You and I must believe and know experientially that God is truly greater. All the time I tried to get free of sin because I didn't want to do it anymore never worked. It was only when I started to experience God's goodness and have that change my heart and say, He is truly better. I want more of Him and less of me. I want more of heaven and less of earth. That was the only time where any amount of victory started happening in my life. Right? If you don't know why you're fighting, if you don't have a strong motivation and reason for doing it, if you don't know your prize, you can't run well. Next point, this ties into it. It's actually kind of the same point. You have to understand genuine grace and God's superior love. You will not run towards God if you think He hates you. If you have a legalistic relationship with God where you feel like that He loves you based on your works or your performance, you will not be able to do this, because how can you run diligently after someone that you think, once I get to him, he's going to smack me in the face for being such a failure all my life? How are you going to run diligently after someone like that? How are you going to turn to God in your moments of stress and anxiety and fear and depression and loneliness when you think all you're going to get from him is scorn? The only way you're going to be able to do that is if you truly believe that there are arms wide open for you when you make that decision. Hebrews 4, verse 15 through 16 says this: we do not have a high priest that cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace and help in our time of need. The only person that could get you and I free of our gluttony, our sin, is Jesus. And if you don't run to Him in your time of need, you will not find victory. Not genuine ones, anyway. And if you think, I'm fighting this so that I can come to God, you will never come to God. You come to God to fight this. You don't fight this to come to Him. That's the point. That's what Hebrews is telling us. You have to go. I love how he describes it too. The throne of grace. When you think of God's throne, do you think of it that way? Man, he could have said anything. He said the throne of power, the throne of wrath, the throne of might, the throne of majesty, all true. But he says, man, the throne of grace. Do you know what you're going to receive when you go to God? Is he going to be the face of someone who is smiling and happy that you came to him, or someone who is scornful that you messed up in the first place? Understanding God's love and genuine grace for you is going to be absolutely essential to your victory over any particular sin in your life. God must be better than whatever you're going to. God must be superior. God must fill us so that we're no longer empty, craving the things of this earth. Proverbs 27, verse 7 says this: the satisfied soul loathes even honey, but to the empty soul, every bitter thing seems sweet. Right? If you're empty, garbage seems pretty appetizing. But when you're satisfied, it doesn't look appetizing anymore. When I'm hungry, pornography seems pretty good. But when I've experienced God's love, it doesn't seem that good anymore. Third and final thing, practically learn how to control your appetite. In the book of Daniel, Daniel is brought into the court of the king, and he knows he's going to be in an environment that's going to be heavily perpetrated by different belief systems and paganism and things that are going to seek to pull his faith away from the true and living God. And Daniel knows he needs to draw the line somewhere. He needs to make sure, I'm not going to go over, I'm not going to become like them. Where does he draw the line, though? This is in Daniel 1, verse 8. Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with a portion of the king's delicacies, nor with wine which he drank. Therefore, he requested to the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. He drew the line at his appetite. How is appetite controlled? It's through consumption. You can't crave something if you don't eat it. Right? If I've never eaten a cheesecake in my entire life, I'm not going to crave it because I don't know what it is. Curiosity might pull me that way, but my appetite won't pull me that way because I don't know what it is. You guys understand that? Daniel understood something. I am not going to toy around with my appetite. I'm not going to indulge a little bit here and a little bit there, thinking I'm strong enough to resist the big meals. Right? He could have easily said, I'll just take a sip. Let's take a little piece. You know, I'll just go a little bit over the line. Daniel understood how frail and fallen he was, and he realizes, if I take a little piece, man, my appetite's going to grow, and eventually I'm going to be just like everybody around me. You need to think of practical ways to stem your appetite. Hey, I wanted desperately to stop viewing porn. Didn't change the fact that I kept viewing it every day. I needed to say, dude, I can't go on these sites. Are they porn? No, but they tempt me to go to porn. I can't do this. I can't do that. I need to have a filter on my computer. I need to limit the amount of time I spend on the internet. I can't play these type of games anymore. I can't do these kind of things. And you know what? All of it was joy. All of it was joy for me because everything I was giving up was giving me one step closer to God, who is better. Count it all as rubbish, man, because he's so much greater. Right? He's so much better. I wasn't bummed out to give those things. I was like, oh my gosh, guys, my life sucks. I don't have Wi-Fi in my house. It's terrible. My life is hell. You know, my smartphone ain't that smart. You know, my life is terrible. Now I look at all those things and it's joy, man. Because I know how weak and frail I am. And I know if I had access like that, I would use it for wrong things. Not that there's anything wrong with those things, but for this heart, it's wrong. It's wrong because I have no self-control. But the more I've abstained, the more I've pushed those things away, and the more I've pursued God, my self-control has gone up. I've gotten better. But it takes time. So I encourage you guys today, no matter where you're at with this struggle of gluttony, there's hope, right? Because it's not our effort towards God, it's God's effort towards us that saves us. And if you are hopeless right now, it's because you're spending too much time focusing on you and not enough time focusing on God and his power and abilities. And the second thing is that in that hope is a call to action. Is God's work in us? Absolutely. But is God's grace that gives us the ability to do these things, to make these genuine steps forward? So know his love. Know his power, and understand your responsibility. Let's pray. God, I thank you so much for your word, that it does convict us in the places that we need to be convicted, and it does encourage us in the ways that we need to be encouraged. So Lord, no matter where any of us are at, Lord, I pray that for those who are in despair, that you give them hope. And for those like myself, who I feel hopeful, God, but I know there's still so much more I need to go forward. There's so much distance between me and you, Lord. There's so much sin that still separates me from you, God. So I confess those sins to you, and I ask you for the strength to keep walking every day, to find your mercy as being new every morning, and to see you as being better. Lord, help us to see you, help us to know you, help us to love you, to experience a relationship with you, and to allow that to change our lives. And in your name, amen.